بسم الله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. أما بعد, to proceed, I was informed that your pizza will be late. So I am supposed to talk now and entertain you until it comes, till your dinner comes. So I'll talk for about half an hour and then I'll have dinner inshallah and Aisha and so on. The issue that I'll talk about today, inshallah, it's an issue about tazkiyah as well. That's a little bit different from the issues that we have been discussing. And that issue is the issue of purification of the heart from all manifestations of self-centrism. And the reason why I'm talking about this issue is recently there was a foreword from the New York Times, like an article, a New York Times article about the Saudi Obama. And the Saudi Obama turned out to be Sheikh Adil al-Kalbani, who was an imam in al-Haram, who was selected to be an imam in al-Haram. I responded, yeah, I don't know how to use those things, but I'm going to respond now. But the issue here is the New York Times, what the New York Times said, and I'm not necessarily saying that they mean anything bad, or the editor sounded to be Muslim, I think. Or the correspondent, I don't know. They sounded to be Muslim. The editor is not Muslim? Okay. But there were many problems. Although, you know, some people may think that this article is positive and they get happy about it, you know, and so on. Yeah, you know, there is a black imam in al-Haram, and that black imam was dubbed as the Saudi Obama, and so on and so forth. The problems that... The problems in the article are big, not small. And why are they big? Because let me tell you this: the issue of racism, and this is pure tazkiyah, because to purify your heart from all of the filth of self-centrism, the issue of racism is one manifestation of self-centrism. Because you love yourself the most, everything to you is based on how far it is from you, because you love yourself the most. Therefore, racism is not different from nationalism, it's not different from tribalism, and it is not different from partisanship, groupism, anything of that nature. Because all of it goes back to one thing, self-centrism. These are manifestations of egotism. These are manifestations that I love myself the most. Therefore, the people who look like me are closer to me than the people who do not look like me. Therefore, the people who are from my same country are closer to me than the people who are not from my same country. Even though the person who's not from your same country could be the best person in the world, you know, if you don't use religious terminology, you can be the most virtuous person, the most truthful person, the most honest person, most kind person. But then you will have more bond with someone from your country who is less in all of the above, because that person who is from your country is Algerian like you, because he is Algerian like you, so you have a common denominator now with that person, which is that he is Algerian. We Algerians are this and that. And it's just like, you know, in every country, you go to every country. We Egyptians, we're not like this. We don't do this. We, you know, and we're the best of the Arabs, and we're the most intelligent, and so on and so forth, and 7,000 years of civilization, we built the pyramids. Because eventually you want to say that I am the best, and anyone who shares those denominators with me will be better than the others, because I am the origin of goodness, the origin of greatness, the origin of all of this. So it all goes back to egotism. The one thing that Islam tries to deroot out of your heart, the one thing that made Iblis disobey Allah in the first place, the first disobedience, first act of disobedience, was because Iblis thought that he's better than Adam, because he was created of fire and Adam was created of clay. So that is the one thing that Islam tries to purify us, the first thing that Islam tries to purify us from. And submission to Allah is purification from this egotism or self-centrism, because now you're not obeying yourself. You're not following your desires or wishes or whims. You're following Allah, and you're following His deen. So, despite that, during times of raqqatul deen, fragile religious commitment, during that times of departure from the deen, certain individuals and certain societies can certainly depart from those Islamic teachings, and they're Muslim, but they can depart from those Islamic teachings. That is true. And it is not only between races, but it's also between nations. And if you look at Morocco and Algeria, for instance, and how much tension there is between Morocco and Algeria, and the families that live across the border, that are split across the border between Morocco and Algeria, they can't meet each other because Morocco and Algeria are angry with each other because, the Moroccans feel that they have rights, or that the Algerians are usurping their rights, and vice versa, and so on. So it's not just between races, it's between nationalities, between anything, any groups that share a common denominator. They try to say that we are better than the other groups. And it could also apply to the Islamic movements and so on and so forth. It applies to anything. It is just partisanship that is based on self-centrism. So that can happen in Muslim societies. What we have to emphasize, we're not going to talk about how egalitarian Islam is, because we don't need to talk about this, right? Islam itself. We do not need to talk about how egalitarian Islam itself is, because we have testimonies of the opponents of the religion throughout the ages saying that this is why it's spreading. It is quite egalitarian. It's very egalitarian. It is not only egalitarian with regard to races or ethnic groups or socioeconomic classes. It is egalitarian with regard to all things. It is a completely egalitarian system. It is even egalitarian with regard to intelligence. It is egalitarian with regard to intelligence, because the Prophet ﷺ said, أَخْوَفُ مَا أَخَفُ عَلَيْكُمْ عُلَمَاءُ السُّءِ. The thing that I fear for you the most are the scholars, are the scholars of wickedness, or the wicked scholars. The fact that you're intelligent does not make you better. It could make you worse. So in every regard, the egalitarian system of Islam is not contestable. However, the practice of the Muslims departs and deviates. And we usually say this, but we have to put here a qualifier, because this is not an absolute statement. Because we usually say the Muslims, the Muslims could do mistakes. But no, yes, the Muslims do mistakes. But Islam still sort of ties them to some extent from going extreme in their evil doing or their wrongdoing. Therefore, practices like Leopold, who was the monarch of Belgium, Leopold in Belgian Congo, he would use kids from Belgian Congo to collect the rubber from trees and so on and so forth. And if the child does not cooperate, these are 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids, if the child does not cooperate or slacks off or does not work enough or does not bring what is required of him at the end of the day, well, what's the punishment?
Cutting
off the hand. They would cut off the hand of that child. So this is a child who is just refusing, who is slacking off, who did not bring enough. It's a little funny how they talk about, you know, the severity of punishments in Islam, where this is the cutting of the hands is for the thieves who are stealing not to eat, because there is there is a threshold here. If you steal to eat, you don't, no one touches you. But there is a threshold here. And if you steal not to eat, but for more, then this will be applied. So anyway, so the children have the practice of lynching, for instance, the burning of villages in Africa and other places. All of those practices Allah protected our ummah from. Others did this. And in this case, when we say others did this, do we mean by others the Europeans? Absolutely not. We mean the non-Muslims. Because the Europeans could be Muslims. Albanians are Muslims. The Bosnians are Muslims. We don't know that the Bosnians did this while they're Muslim, or the Albanians did this while they're Muslim. So the issue here is not Albanian versus Arab, or is not European versus Asian, European versus African. It is Muslim versus non-Muslim, and we have to always keep this in focus, Muslim and non-Muslim, because it doesn't really matter where you come from, your location, your shape, etc., your convictions, the deen that moves you, the deen that dictates to you what to do and what not to do. Even if you depart from it, it will still have some effect on you as long as you subscribe to that religion. Not all the Europeans, not even all the Christian Europeans. We're talking about some. Because there are Christian Europeans who fought for equality and died for equality. And all of you know the emancipation and the people who fought, the Europeans who fought for emancipation and so on and so forth. So we're talking about certain groups of non-Muslims. Not all of them, but certain group amongst non-Muslims. Within our ummah, this did not happen. That is not because we as Arabs or Indians or Albanians or anything are better people by nature. No, we were worse or the same, or some of us were better, some of us were worse, the same. So the issue here is not that we Arabs or we Indians or we Asians or East Asians or Albanians or East Europeans, anything, are better. It is because Islam did have some effect on us, even when we departed from it, even when we departed from it to a great extent, didn't we? We departed to a great extent. People abandoned the prayers. You know, if you talk about the beginning of this last century, that there was a large sector of Muslims who were not even praying. There is no hijab, no prayers. Pretty much the religion was sort of pushed back into the masajid. And in the masajid, you would find elders who were sort of like waiting there to die. But the shabab or the young people or the youth, you know, why do I need to go to the masjid? I'm not close to death yet. So that was the concept. And when we deviate in those areas, and we deviate in the area of nationalism or racism or this or that, because we deviated in all areas. If someone is not committed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he doesn't pray in the first place, then you would not expect him to commit to all of those virtues and to purge his heart from the filth of self-centrism and all of the manifestations attached to it. So that is something that we have to say, that despite the fact that we deviate, we've never deviated this far. We've never deviated like the KKK. We've never, you know, had, we never tortured children because they look different. We never burned children because they look different. We've never deviated this far. And it is not our ethnic background or racial background, it is Islam that withheld us from getting this far in our deviation. Yes, we can be oppressors, absolutely. Yes, we can be arrogant and proud and this and that and racist and. But we never go this far because Islam still has some effect. And the more effect it has on us, the closer it will bring us to the truth, which is bring us to the complete purification of the heart from all of these feelings and manifestations. Now, so that is something that has to be confirmed. And when you say that this is a precedent, President Obama, precedent, and you know people are following his footsteps now, and you bring in the Imam from Al-Haram to be an example of, like a Saudi Obama, well, you know, it gets real. This is not something foreign to Al-Haram by any means. When the Prophet ﷺ entered the Kaaba, there were two people on his right side and his left side. Who are those two people? Bilal and Osama. Both are black. Bilal and Osama. Both are black. Bilal is from two African parents. Osama was from an Arab slave, a father who was a freed slave, but he was Arab, because slavery was not racial. Zayd ibn Haritha was Arab and slave, and Umayman, his mother, who was an African slave. So Osama was black, and Bilal was black, because Zayd and Umayman had Osama, who was completely black to the point where people started to think that he's not the son of Zayd. And the Prophet was quite distressed until someone came, Al-Ta'if came, and looked at Zayd, the feet of Zayd and the feet of Osama, and he said, "Inna hadhihi al-aqdam ba'duha min ba'd." So the Prophet was elated by this. So when the Prophet entered the Kaaba, and entering al-Kaaba on the day of opening Mecca, that's the peak. That is the peak in the Prophet's history, in the history of his victory. So Bilal was on the right side, and Osama was on the left side. And Bilal is the one who was asked to rise on top of the Kaaba and give the adhan. And it was not only Bilal that was prominent amongst the Sahaba. Umm Ayman is African. And the Prophet ﷺ always called her Ummi, Ya Umma, O Mother. So he always called her mother, and because she is the one who took care of him while his mother was alive and after his mother died as well. And the Prophet always was very close to her, like one is close to his mother, to the point where after the Prophet ﷺ died, Abu Bakr and Umar would go and visit her to keep the tradition, the legacy of the Prophet ﷺ. So Umm Ayman, Osama, as I said, and Osama was not only Osama used to be called the beloved son of the beloved, Al-Hibb ibn Al-Hibb, beloved, because the Prophet ﷺ loved them very much, to the point where when they wanted to seek someone to intercede with the Prophet ﷺ regarding the woman from Bani Makhzum who stole something. You know, there was a woman, like a noble woman from Bani Makhzum, who stole something, and that was the punishment, cutting off her hand. And then they looked around to find someone to intercede with the Prophet to prevent this. So they went to Osama, because, you know, he would be the closest to the Prophet's heart, because he was Al-Hibb ibn Al-Hibb, the beloved son of the beloved. The Prophet ﷺ certainly reprimanded Osama, and he said to him, "أَتَشْفَعُ فِي حَدٍ مِنْ حُدُودِ اللَّهِ." Are you interceding to suspend a punishment that Allah had prescribed? But the issue here is that they looked around and they went to Usama because they knew that he would be the closest to the heart of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Not only that he was al-Hibb ibn al-Hibb, but also Usama was a leader of an army that had Abu Bakr and Umar when he was only 18. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam assigned them or designated them as the leader of the army that was going to fight the Romans and their allies who were threatening the northern part of the peninsula. And he sent Abu Bakr and Umar as soldiers under the leadership of Usama, who was at that time only 18 years of age. You see, Ubadah ibn Samit, when he went, although Ubadah was Arab, but he was black, Ubadah ibn Samit, when he went to negotiate with the Cyrus, the Archbishop of Egypt, Cyrus, and the Archbishop of Egypt said to the delegation, "Take this away from me. I fear from him," because he was very black. So Ubadah ibn Samit, the delegation said to Muqawqis, Cyrus, said to him, "Hadha khayruna وأفضلنا وأحكمنا فإما أن تكلمه أو لا تكلم أحدا." This is the best of us, the most wise of us, and the most knowledgeable of us. You either talk to him or talk to no one. So he accepted to talk to him. So Ubadah ibn Samit, he said to him, the first thing he said to him, "If you fear from my blackness, we have 1,000 blacker than me in the army." So the issue here, Kafur al-Ikhshidi, within 300 years, Kafur al-Ikhshidi, who's African, was ruling over Egypt. This was something that you would not imagine in a country like Egypt, you know, a country that's proud of its history and proud of its people and so on and so forth. But this country would be ruled by Kafur al-Ikhshidi in the 4th century, who was African. And Egypt is Africa, but African I mean by the sub-Saharan Africa, African, Kafur al-Ikhshidi. So that switch, what made the switch? It is Islam. It is Islam that made the switch in Egypt that would make the Egyptians be ruled and accept the rulership, someone like this. That's during the time of the Sahaba, those are just prominent blacks during the time of the Sahaba. If you look at the time of the Tabi'in, the time of the Tabi'in was called in its entirety Asr al-Mawali, the era of the freed slaves, because the freed slaves are the ones who sort of capture the lights, who jump to the front of the scene in many regards, particularly in knowledge, particularly as scholars and muftis and imams and preachers in Mecca and Medina, and so on and so forth, to the point where they dominated the scene. The freed slaves, remember, they don't have to be African. They're African, they're Persian, they're Arab. They're just freed slaves who Islam came to sort of liberate all of their energy that was suppressed. So within just a few years, you know, during the time of Umar ibn al-Khattab, you're talking about, you know, Arabia at the time, this is classism and tribalism at its best. And during a few years, Abdul Rahman ibn Abza was a freed slave, was the deputy governor of Mecca. Mecca is the pearl of Arabia. And Abdul Rahman ibn Abza was an African slave that was freed, and then he became the deputy governor of Mecca. And thereafter, Umar ibn al-Khattab took him to pray in Medina because of his beautiful recitation, to pray in Medina after Ubay ibn Ka'b. And thereafter, Ali ibn Abi Talib took Abdul Rahman ibn Abza to be the ruler of Khurasan, which is Iran. From the Asr of al-Tabi'in, for instance, and I'm giving you very few examples because, you know, I'm trying to rush here. I have only 5 minutes. But I'm giving you like glimpses, very few examples. Like Ata, for instance, during the time of At-Tabi'in, the Khalifa would send people to announce in al-Hajj, throughout Mecca and Mina and so on, no one shall give any fatwa except Ata. Ata was African. Ata, completely, purely African, sub-Saharan African. And the Khalifa himself would come and sit in the Majlis Ata and listen to him. So these are prominent people from the time of Tabi'in. After this, the examples don't stop. Therefore, to make it look like, this is like, look at this, they are also advancing like us. Well, this is really like a joke, now, people say that, but this is an imam and this is not a governor. Well, the Imam of al-Haram is bigger than a governor, that's for sure, to the Muslims, to all of the Muslims. However, the issue here is, it's a monarchy. The regular Saudis are not, they don't have a share in this governorship because it is a monarchy. Whether you like it or not, but it is a monarchy. Also, the Muslim countries are divided into very small countries and they were divided. Someone divided the Muslim countries into very small pieces. So it's natural that every people will rule themselves. So it's natural that the president of Senegal will be black and the president of Albania will be white. Very natural. And the president of Malaysia will be Asian looking. It's very natural. But when you have a place, for instance, like Egypt, where you have all grades of color, where you have all shades of color, As-Sadat was black. And his blackness did not exclude him from the presidency, the former president, People did not like him, not because he was black, but because of Camp David and signing the treaty with Israel. So that is the issue here. The issue here is, despite the fact that this article may look good, it is not good. It has defects. And then the mention of slavery at the end of the article is also intended, we're not having slavery only here, it was all over the place, and so on and so forth. I on my website, I have like a little article about slavery in Islam and the difference between slavery in Islam and slavery in other regimes. But the one thing that needs to be mentioned, that needs to be first mentioned, is that slavery in Islam was not a racial practice. That's it. So Al-Hasan al-Basri, freed slave, Persian. It is not a racial practice. There were Arabs, Zayd ibn Haritha, there were Persians, there were Africans, and it was not a racial practice intended against one particular race. So that's one thing. The other thing about, the treatment, the difference in treatment and so on and so forth, and the issue that people always felt that those slaves are human being, complete human beings, but they are in a different role, but they did not feel that they are not, that they're less of human beings, to the point where the Muslims during the era of al-Mamalik, Asr al-Mamalik, the dynasty of the Mamluks, these are slaves. And they ruled over the majority of the heart of the Muslim land. Egypt, greater Syria, and Hejaz, and so on and so forth. These were the rulers over all of this, and these were slaves that ruled. So the idea here was a matter of roles, not a matter of defectiveness, or a matter of being less human. But the most important thing that we should always start with is to say that slavery was not a racial practice. Slavery was not a racial practice. And the one thing that would allow people to take slaves is the prisoners of war. And the prisoners of war were a dilemma at the time, because he can't feed thousands of people. That's why Napoleon killed them all when he opened Akka acre. That's why Richard the Lionhearted killed them all when he was able to defeat, I think it's Akka as well. So he killed them all. But so the slavery was a way to save them, spare them. And anyway, so that's it. That's what I wanted to say. These are all important things that we shouldn't be superficial. We shouldn't look at these things and say, oh, well, you see, it's nice. They're talking nice about us here.
Kind of in the whole, oh, everyone is in change now, you know, like America.
Oh, well, that's what the article is inferring, and that's what most of the ignorant people will, even the Muslims, will be sort of enchanted with the article. They're talking good about us. They're saying that we're also good like them and we're also improving. And the issue here, the bottom line is that you have to be sure that you're not unfair. Because if you say that Europeans did this, it is unfair. Some Europeans did that. And the issue here is not Europeans and non-Europeans. It is Muslims and non-Muslims. So you keep, you have to know where you are coming from. We're not defending any ethnic group. We're not defending any race against any race. We're talking about Islam as in what the impact of Islam on this ummah in this regard. Because take Islam away from us, we can be the worst. You see, the Cyrus of Egypt, the Archbishop of Egypt, he didn't even want to talk to Ahmad ibn Samit. He was that repulsed by his features or by his, you know, shape that he was afraid, that he didn't even want to, that he is the head of the delegate that is coming to negotiate with him what? Surrender. He's the one who needs to talk to him with Ubadah ibn Samit, because Ubadah came to negotiate surrender with him. And then he said, no, I would not talk to, let me talk to anyone else. So it is not because Egyptians are better than Europeans or, no, it is Islam and just Islam. You take it back and then we revert to where we were. And it is not just, it's not just black and white and Asian and so on. But it is the self-centrism, because like if you talk to people, for instance, from Egypt, they will tell you, the blacks, certain people, certainly, you know, have no piety. They have those features, and the Asians have those features, and they also will tell you the Europeans have those features, you know, they have criticism for everyone that is not just like them. You know, they're not attractive, they're lifeless, they're this, they're that. We are attractive, and we're good, you know. And we're more handsome and stuff like that. So it is self-centrism. The issue here is that in Al-Haram, if you see that the President Obama in the White House, this is remarkable, but in Al-Haram, I'm quite sure the majority of people in Haram, they will not even notice Al-Kalbani. They will not notice that it is not noticeable. It's not new to Al-Haram, and it doesn't come to mind there at all. So it's something that will not be noticed. But we're made to notice it, and we're made to think that this is an achievement for us.
Yeah, there are others who at least.
Yeah, with the question that
yes.
That was going to work on the project.
No, it's aimed for Muslims and non-Muslims. It aims to exhibit the beauty of Islam and answer misconceptions. And we don't only want people who are scholars. We want people to research, people to learn on the job. Do you know that learning on the job was the way of the Sahaba in learning? You see, nowadays we get the kids to memorize the whole Quran in 1 year, you know, or in a couple of years, and then they start to understand. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud taught al-Quran to one of his companions over 16 years. He would teach him an ayah a day. If you divide the Quran, by the way, it will be like this. If you teach an ayah a day, you'll finish it in 16 years. So he taught one of his companions the Quran over 16 years, but he really understood each ayah. You know, because it's an ayah day, so you memorize this ayah, you're free to get it down, and then you move on to the next ayah. So we need to be learning on the job. So the people who will feel timid to research and to bring us, you know, their work so that we can have, you know, like a group discussion, we can finalize our answers, the various misconceptions that bring us to bring us their own thoughts about how this particular issue raised their iman, strengthened their iman. They'll try to bring things that, you know, like scientific proofs, economical, historical, etc. Despite the fact that we believe in people's equality, but will it make me happy that that the president of the University of Minnesota converted to Islam? Will it make me happier if the president of the University of Minnesota converted to Islam versus an ordinary person? Honestly speaking, I'll tell you yes. That is not because the president of Minnesota is better in the sight of Allah than the ordinary person, but that is adding strength to the religion. Didn't the Prophet ﷺ pray that Umar ibn Khattab or Amr ibn Hisham become Muslim because of their strength, because of their power, because of their energy, their capacity? Like if you are sailing in a boat and you find someone drowning, and then you pick them up, and then and the boat is having trouble because there are high winds and so on, and you find that person to be a good sailor, you get happier. He'll help you, you know. So it is not particularly racial or anything, but it is, you get happy when you find that someone will contribute to the religion, will contribute to Islam. Such as the Senegalese monarch who converted to Islam, and remember this is how Senegal converted to Islam. The monarch converted first, and then the elites. He didn't force anyone to convert, by the way, but the monarch converted first, and then the elites, and so on and so forth. So the news of that Senegalese monarch converting to Islam, and he actually went to Hajj, and he brought so much gold and so much stuff with him to Al-Kaaba and so on, that makes the Muslims delighted, because that's a king, you know. He will add power to the religion. Yes.